Move on to our next case, United States versus Christensen. Mr. Mielek. Ahead.
Okay, please, the court. Good morning, Your Honors. Co-appellant counsel Reed Cornea is going to be splitting the time with me today. I'm going to address the district court's calculation of loss. He's going to talk about the terrorism enhancement. The district court found a $40,000 loss to the United States government for an experiment that the United States Forest Service had abandoned. Our argument is that the government effectively lost nothing.
Why did it take 8 years for this for the case to arise? I don't understand. What was going on in the 8 years?
I think you'll have to ask the government that, Your Honor. I don't know.
You don't know.
My guess is they were interviewing witnesses.
Eight years interviewing witnesses.
And there were prosecutions going on all over the country that related to the Earth Liberation Front.
Okay. Well, I'm just curious. Idle curiosity.
In the year 2000, the government's sole witness at the sentencing hearing testified. He didn't say specifically when, but he said the year 2000, and the damage that occurred to government property happened in July of 2000. The experiment that was damaged simply was not funded anymore.
Well, so what? I don't understand that.
Well, it's
but if the your client hadn't destroyed the trees, then okay, they would have this information, the data from all the trees, and they write up, you know, an article or something. The fact that the experiment doesn't go on any longer doesn't mean it's a worthless experiment.
Well, I agree with you, that's probably not the case. The data has some worth. The government's expert during the hearing disagreed and said that without the trees, the data is worthless. Without the data, the trees are worthless.
I don't follow you.
Well,
if the trees hadn't been destroyed, there would have been the data, and even though the experiment didn't continue, there would be the data from the experiment until it ended, and then, you know, they would draw some inferences about this genetic modification of trees. So I understand.
Yeah. What I understand Your Honor to be saying is that they could have continued the experiment without...
No. I'm assuming the experiment stops. That doesn't mean that the experimentation that's been done up to that date is worthless just because the experiment is terminated, right?
But they have the data up to that point. And if they're not going to need the trees anymore to continue analyzing the data and drawing conclusions from it, then they could do that as well, whether or not the trees are there or not.
But there are no other trees like this. These trees were developed specifically as part of this experiment, and without the trees, then the data is interrupted. It can't go on. They've got to start all over.
Yes, if there was any intent to continue with the experiment, which it appears there was not. It's sort of like...
Well, what was going to happen to the trees? This is really Judge Tinder's question. Well, what was going to happen? They weren't going to knock the trees down, were they? The government?
I think the record is silent about that, Your Honor, but I guess they would have just left them growing there.
Which came first, the damage or the ceasing of the project?
I tried to check that based on the transcript just before coming in here, Your Honor, and it appears the record is silent as to that. The government's witness said that in the year 2000, the funding discontinued.
Well, they didn't discontinue the funding because the projects were destroyed, or...
There's no evidence that the funding discontinued
there's no evidence that connects the two then.
No, and I think it's reasonable to infer that had funding discontinued because of the damage, that the government's witness would have emphasized that point.
Well, of course, that's 8 years later. I guess he would.
I see I'm almost out of time. If there's more questions, I should
try. Weren't your clients scared off of the damage they were doing as well? Didn't they intend to do other damage? And the intended loss is really what we look to, isn't it?
I think that the intent wasn't to cause loss so much as it was to draw attention to.
Well, in their statement, didn't they say we got scared off early or got chased off because some car arrived?
Yes.
So the work they were doing, or the damage they were doing, was interrupted.
It's unclear whether that would have been more damage or if they wanted to complete the graffiti that they performed on some of the U.S. Source vehicles, which is undisputed damage that it is calculable. I mean, here the damage that the government's witness testified to is basically purely speculative. He was not somebody who handled funds, as far as the record shows. He didn't write the grants, as far as the record shows. He didn't administer money. He had to ask if there were records kept, and found out there weren't any. He's basically doing his best guess, and I think he made his honest best guess. If I had to guess how much money I spent on coffee between 2000 and 2005, I could come up with a number, but I don't think it would be particularly reliable. I don't think that a court would find that I'd met my burden of proof to a preponderance of evidence if I asked for an award based on that estimate.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Mitchell. Mr. Cornea?
May it please the court, counsel. Reed Cornea, appearing on behalf of Brian Lefebvre-Rivera. I want to just really briefly touch on a couple of questions that were asked in regards to the trees. First off, the California poplar is one of the most studied trees in the Forest Service as well as academia. It is known throughout the field of silviculture. It has been studied since the late 19th century. It was the first tree to have its genome done. This project went from 1983 to 1993, when the trees reached maturity. And thus there was no need to collect any more data because in 1993 the trees reached maturity. Furthermore, the California poplar is a tree, like all cottonwoods, that is, you can cut a branch off, it'll grow roots. This is how these trees propagate. And they also propagate by sending shoots out. So if there was a concern about saving stock, all they had to do is cut the roots off, and they would save the genetic stock, period. That didn't happen. In regards to what I'm going to argue about, is the question of the rationale behind the terrorism enhancement in this case and the application of that in this case.
But it's just a kind of mechanical putting together different statutory provisions, right?
In a sense, it is mechanical, but I think you also, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I was taught from, I think, the first day of law school that when you read a statute, you read a statute as a whole. You can't pick and choose what you want out of that statute. I mean, I run into this problem all the time with jailhouse lawyers who advise my clients about these great things they can do, and they send me these statutes and say, well, look at this. This is what the statute says. And then I say, well, you got to stand back a second. Read the whole statute. 3A14 cites to Title 18 U.S.C. 2332B, acts of terrorism transcending national boundaries. And then it goes on and says, well, if the definition in that statute of what transcending national boundaries is listed, one of these enumerated statutes, then the terrorism enhancement is in place. And therefore, we give you your 12, and then your 14, your Category 6. I mean, it has some very detrimental effects.
I don't know how you can reach result you want without disregarding, you know, really explicit statutory language.
Statutory language in
what is it, 25255G or something, whatever that provision is, which
2332B. Are you talking about the statute dealing with transcending national?
Yeah, 2GB5, mm-hmm. Isn't it?
The language clearly states these are the crimes that trigger the statute.
Right.
But as a whole, these are the crimes that, if they transcend national boundaries, trigger the statute. Look, 2332B stems from, or its progeny, or its antecedent.
Yes, I know, but the guideline seems not interested in that, you know, history. It just points to 2332B G5, right? The fact that 2332BG5 has a history and a context and so on, that doesn't seem to be what the guideline framers were interested in, right?
I think they were, it's hard to say what they're interested in, because this is a poorly written part of it.
No, it's not poorly written. I understand. You don't.
Because we have 2331, which deals with domestic terrorism, which is a much broader statute.
But it doesn't even matter, because you can always argue to the judge that even though the guidelines point, you know, to this statute, considering the context and so on and so forth, this, you know, really shouldn't be considered terrorism. Isn't that true? Or did he give the minimum statutory sentence or what?
Well, in fact, and I'll credit to Judge Crabb, who I have a great respect for, she downward departed greatly in this case.
Right.
My client to 36, I think.
And sentenced your client even about where your client would have been sentenced without this terrorism enhancement under the guidelines.
The problem is
so what's
that,
the point?
Well, the point is, do you want to go through your life with a labeled a terrorist? It's already when he first went down to his prison in Texas, he gets pulled aside by his unit manager and says, "We don't want any trouble from you because of the allegations." So it creates problems, and it will continue to create problems throughout his life. And it's his position that he's not a terrorist. So I see my time's up, and I appreciate it.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Cornea. Ms. Duschenman?
Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is Meredith Guzman, and I represent the United States in this case. Let me begin by answering a question, and that was, why did this prosecution take so long? And it's kind of an interesting segue into the Earth Liberation Front. Unlike traditional environmentalists who basically would, you know, cross a line and say, arrest me, and then they would draw sympathy for their cause by being arrested and by being martyrs, that sort of thing, the Earth Liberation Front takes a completely different tact. They essentially sneak in the middle of the night, they burn something down, they blow it up, or they, in this case, you know, damage a bunch of stuff. But they take great pains to wear disguises, to wear gloves, so that they can sneak back out and not be caught. That's exactly what happened in this case. What they did was they came in the middle of the night, they wore gloves, they wore clothes, and then on the way back to Minneapolis, they disposed of all of that stuff so that there'd be no forensic evidence. And so the case just simply went cold for years. It was officially closed. And it wasn't until, I don't think, maybe early 2007 or late 2006 that an individual was implicated in some arsons out west and started to talk, and they started to kind of put the pieces together, and agencies started to talk, and we had to kind of scramble to put this case together before the 8-year statute of limitations expired. Mm-hmm. So that's why it did take so long. The court sort of alluded to this, and I want to touch on this as well. This court has made clear repeatedly that a district court has to properly calculate an advisory guideline range. And there really isn't such a thing as a harmless error argument. But I think there is a practical reality to both of these situations in the sense that we're arguing about enhancements that were really negated by the eventual sentence anyway. For example, in Ms. Christensen's case, she's challenging the loss amount. At sentencing, the government asserted that the loss was between $400,000 and $1 million. The defendant said that he thought a loss of $209 seemed more appropriate. The original level was 14. He said that was a level 12, but he also asked the court, hey, since 209 is close to 200, can you just go down one more level to a level 10? Well, if you take the base offense level of 6, which is undisputed, plus the level 10, which is what the defendant asked for at sentencing, in his ideal world, plus the terrorism enhancement, which Christensen has not appealed, the advisory guideline range would be 110 to 137 months. Ms. Christensen got a sentence of 24 months.
So I'm sorry, got what?
She got a sentence of 24 months. And so even in the perfect world, if you prevailed on appeal and the court said you have to give this advisory guideline range of 110 to 137 months, she's already gotten a sentence that's a fifth of that. And I understand that there are arguments that, well, maybe if the sentence, maybe if the advisory guideline range was 110 to 137, maybe she would have gotten less than 24. But when you've got a court already going from a guideline range of 188 down to 24, so you've already got a variance of 164 months, if the court really felt like a sentence of 18, 19, or 20 was really more reasonable, you know, she could have varied the extra couple of months. And so I would ask the court to consider that. And again, as Your Honor pointed out, it's sort of the same thing with Mr. Rivera. Talking about Mr. Rivera, it is the government's position that the court did not err when it applied the terrorism enhancement in 3A1.4. There were two things plainly required. The crime that was committed was a federal crime of terrorism, and the offense was calculated to influence or coerce the conduct of government. The defendant really concedes that he meets both of those technical requirements, but he tries to avoid the enhancement by asking the court to read in a third requirement, and that requirement is that the conduct transcended national boundaries. His rationale is because 3A1.4 has a cross-reference in it to 18 United States Code Section 2332 sub B sub G sub 5, and then because that larger statute has a title in it that says Acts Terrorism Transcending National Boundaries, that must mean, as a matter of statutory interpretation, that 3A1.4 requires that the conduct transcend national boundaries. This rationale is flawed. If you take a look at 18 United States Code Section 2332B, it's called Acts of Terrorism Transcending National Boundaries, and it's called that because it's a criminal statute that creates a crime for that. It's just like any other statute. It says here's the name of the crime, here's the elements of the crime, here's the penalties of the crime. And then, like a lot of statutes, it has a definition section. And one of the definitions it lays out is federal crime of terrorism. The cross-reference in 3A1.4 is only to that specific section of 2332B. The application note in 3A1.4 says, quote, federal crime of terrorism defined. For the purposes of this guideline, federal crime of terrorism has the meaning given that term in 18 United States Code, Section 2332BG5. The defendant argues somehow that because the guideline cross-references a specific definition in the criminal statute, a whole different criminal statute, that the elements of that crime should somehow be imported into the guideline. And there are just no cases to support that as a matter of statutory interpretation or otherwise. In fact, the court can take note of the case the United States cites, United States versus Harris, which is a Fifth Circuit case that rejects this exact theory in the context of 3A1.4. The language of the guideline is plain and ambiguous. It says what it says. I think you get a flavor from oral argument that really the defendant's concern with this requirement is not what it says, but more of a political problem with being labeled a terrorist, and I don't think that...
Is the terror part the threat and the coercion and the idea that you're trying to scare people who are involved in whatever they don't like to away from doing it? Is that the terror part as opposed to just civil disobedience? I guess when we put that definition on it these days, it's a serious definition, but there does seem to be some coercive or threatening aspect to this.
That is required for the enhancement. One of the two factors in 3A1.4 is that you do it with a specific purpose. And you have to do it with a purpose to coerce or intimidate or retaliate against government. It is limited to that specific purpose, and the defendant doesn't really argue that's what they were doing, and all you have to do is really look at the communique that was sent out in the name of the defendants to the press to really kind of get a flavor for what the intimidating act was with regard to the service.
But why is 2332B captioned acts of terrorism transcending national boundaries when the definitions include purely domestic terrorism? Seems odd.
It is odd, Your Honor. I can only assume that they called it federal, you know, that they called it that because that was the name of the crime they were creating with the statute. And they created a definition section, and as the court is aware, it's not uncommon for a guideline or a statute to say, for the purposes of this, we're going to go ahead and define it like this other completely unrelated thing. And
why didn't they just repeat the definition rather than sending people chasing across to another statute? Just quote it, right? You don't have to have a cross reference.
And Congress took that constantly, having to cross reference everything and to make things a lot easier. Your Honor, I see that my time is growing.
Okay.
If the court has any questions, we'd ask you to affirm the sentences of the defendants.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Duschman. So is there anything further from either of the defendants' lawyers? Okay, sure. You can have a minute if you want, sure.
The government's position is there's no cases that support our argument for statutory interpretation. Well, there are plenty of them, starting with Platt v. Union Pacific going back to the 19th century. We have Shapiro.
But do you think, for example, that people can't be prosecuted under 2332B if there's no international connection?
I think there has to be an international connection. That's the name of the statute. And
yeah, but the subdivision, you know, actually I think there's a rule or something that if there's an inconsistency between the caption of a statute and the language of the statute, the language takes precedence.
Your Honor, but I think we have to look at the 2331 domestic terrorism, which is actually a much broader statute than what it encompasses.
Well, there's loads of overlapping federal criminal statutes.
So, I mean, I guess the Sentencing Commission wanted to cite to a statute that appropriately met the requirements that they're trying to seek. They should have cited to 2331 sub 5. That's the appropriate statute. And it's because we have a narrow statute that is transcending national boundaries, a statute being submerged into or covered up by a rule, a regulation. And under case law, that's not appropriate. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much to both counsel. You're both appointed, were you not? So we thank you for your efforts on behalf of the next case.